Okay, it's roughly 8 o'clock now, so we'll begin this morning's talk. And the morning talks are for the further progress of one's meditation. And yesterday I talked about some of the obstacles one has in meditation. And today I was going to talk about one of those factors which really help the meditation along, namely mindfulness. And just how important mindfulness is, what it is, and how one develops it. Now, the first thing to know about mindfulness, it's not just something which one either has or one doesn't have, but it's mindfulness has different degrees. Just dull mindfulness and brighter mindfulness. What I wrote in my book, coining some new terms, like power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. Because this is actually what happens when one practices meditation. The mind becomes empowered and the mindfulness increases. And as that mindfulness increases, one sees more, one can oversee the mind with greater skill, and also other wonderful things happen, which I will tell you in a few moments. But the important thing to know from here, from the beginning, is that mindfulness is so important and it is cultivated little by little. And to understand how mindfulness is cultivated, actually how you grow mindfulness, is one of the classic stories, a simile from my own life, which tells you what mindfulness is and why it grows the less you do. And it's a simile of my monastery, which is 2 kilometers on top of a hill. And as many of you know, the reason why many monasteries are on top of hills is because that's where holy people are supposed to live. On top of hills or mountains. With the exception, so my young monks tell me, there's one guy who doesn't live, a holy person who doesn't live on a mountain. It's the only holy person in our culture who lives in a swamp. And that holy person who lives in a swamp apparently is Yoda from Star Wars. But that's not real life, that's only movies. Most, because we built our monastery on top of a hill, it was for about, must have been about 7-8 years. I would always be going up and down that hill in a vehicle. But on this one occasion, I decided to walk up that steep hillside. Now remember, I've been going up and down that hill for 7, 8, 9 years. I can't remember exactly how much. And when you go up and down that hillside where you live, you assume that you know your environment because you've been going up and down it every few days for 9 years. But when I got out of the vehicle, told the driver, meet me at the top, it's a nice morning, I got the time, let me walk, something very, very strange happened. As I started walking up the hillside to my monastery, I could not recognize my surroundings. It was as if I was walking up a different hillside. They were seeing things I'd never noticed before, and it was so strange why I'd never seen these before when I'd been living up there for about 9 years, that I stopped and stared. And I noticed as I stopped and stared, the hillside changed again. When I stopped, I could see more detail. I saw more information, the rocks, the bushes, even the grass. I saw much more when I became still, and what I saw looked far more beautiful. And, being a bit of a scientist before, it was such a weird experience for me that I thought about it, and obviously the reason is this. When you are looking through the window of a moving car, the light which comes into your eye and falls on the retina at the back of your eye does not have sufficient time to form a proper image before some new light comes in, dislodges the old, and the mind has to attend to another image. So when you're looking through the window of a car which is speeding, all you see is flashes of what's out there. They're not fully formed pictures. The detail hasn't really manifested, and your mind doesn't have time to really investigate it all, before you have to do something else. And it's the same thing, similar thing happened when I was walking. As I was walking, I was going slower, so the light had more time to form an image on the back of the eye, which is why I saw much more. And what I saw, the colors were much deeper, the detail was easily to see. But even walking was a bit fast, because I was walking still. The old light had to be dislodged while I saw a new image. It was only when I was absolutely still and just stared, only then did the light have all the time it needed to form a perfect image in the back of my eye, and my mind had enough time to investigate that image. Because of that, only when I was still did I see the whole hillside in all its detail. And what was more interesting, because that image had enough time to establish itself, all the colors were very rich. So the greens were deep green, the blues were deep blue, and everything looked very beautiful. Now that's a great simile to start off with the mindfulness and how it's achieved. Sometimes that people live their life and understand very little, because they live their life as if they were in a speeding car looking out the window. And they think they know their surroundings, they think they know the people they live with, they even think they know themselves. But all they know is just flashes, little half-formed pieces of information about life. And because they have to attend to something new so quickly afterwards, they never really have time to fully investigate what's going on. Many people live their life as if in a speeding car looking out. But the slower we go, the more we see. When you go slower, you can actually see, even feel, even hear more detail. And the slower one goes, the more one sees. When one stops and becomes still, only then can you see fully, hear fully, feel fully, and know deeply. And the thing which surprised me, but now I understand is an important part of meditation, the slower you go, it's not that you just see more and feel more and are more mindful, but the slower you go, what you experience becomes more delightful, more beautiful. Now, the first time I realized this, how that mindfulness is empowered by stillness, and not just you see more, but what you see becomes more beautiful or delightful, was one of the first retreats I did when I was still a student at Cambridge, when we hired, during the vacation period, a couple of student boarding houses. Now, there's one thing which you should know about the country of England 35, 40 years ago. That there was much culture in England, but the part of culture which they never developed at all in those early years was their cooking. Anybody, say from Penang, who visited England really had to endure sort of the terrible cooking of the English a long time ago. They did not have the skills, say, of the French or of the Italians to cook something delicious. Whatever vegetables they had, they'd just boil them. Any sort of other things, they'd fry them. They wouldn't put any sauces in, and they were not sensitive to the different flavors and tastes. So the cooks of England were not regarded as particularly high up the scale of cooks in the world. And worse than that, of all the cooks in that whole island, the bottom of the heap would be the ones who cooked for students in boarding houses. So when I learnt that the retreat was going to be held in a boarding house for 9 days, I thought, well, the meditation might be fun, but this food is going to be disgusting. And so I braced myself for 9 days of terrible meals. At least you know here you get some nice food when you come on retreat. You know, it's local food, people are very kind, and very often they cook the very best. But I knew this was going to be a terrible food. But I was quite surprised. On the meals, they started to taste quite delicious. At the time, I thought we must have struck lucky. Maybe because of my good karma, we got the only cook in all the boarding houses in the whole of England who could actually give some taste to the meals. But it was only later I realized that no, that was just an ordinary, bottom of the scale, cheap cook who didn't have any training at all. The only reason why it tasted delicious was because my mindfulness was increasing, and what little taste was left after the cook boiled or smashed these things into bits like mashed potato or mashed this, what little taste was left, I was aware enough to pick up. That's why it tasted delicious. And now I tell this to people on my retreats, and they'll say, yeah, that's amazing. When you go on a retreat, after the first few days, the food starts to taste more and more delicious. In fact, the food will taste more delicious on a retreat than any other time in your life. And the only reason is, because of your mindfulness, you're more awake, you can pick up more of what's in the food. So test that out on the next couple of days. You'll probably find that the ordinary food which you taste on this retreat, if you taste it outside, you taste it on this retreat, it will taste better here. Simply because your mindfulness has increased. And I tell people the moral of that story is, if ever you go out with your friends to an expensive restaurant where you have to pay a lot of money for your food, please meditate for an hour beforehand to get your money's worth. Otherwise, you're wasting good cash. But that's just an example of what happens when mindfulness increases. Your quality of sensory experience increases. You're more alert, more aware, more awake. Whatever you see, whatever you taste, whatever you hear is just more delightful, simply because your mind has more energy. So, to go back, what we're doing, we're making the mind still so that mindfulness could increase. Now, going up the hillside in a car, it's going fast, you don't see very much. It's going slower and slower, you see more, what you see is more beautiful. You stop, you see everything, and what you see is really delightful. So in this path of meditation, by slowing down the mind, coming to stillness, at the same time, you're seeing more. This is where you get the insight, comes from stillness. The slower you go, the more still you are, the deeper you see. And the other wonderful benefit is the more happy you are. Whatever you see is more interesting, more delightful. For another example, on that retreat, every morning we were encouraged to go for a walk before breakfast for exercise. So because I knew this was in Cambridge, because I knew Cambridge, I was a student there, I decided to go every morning for a walk in the botanical gardens. And it was supposed to be for exercise. It was only about 3 or 4 minutes away from the boarding house. But every morning, or rather 8 mornings out of the 9, for the 9th one I went for a walk by the river, for 8 mornings out of 9, when I got to that botanical gardens, just at the entrance, there was this amazing clump of bamboo. And the first day I got there, I looked at that, and my goodness, that was so beautiful. And I don't know if you've seen, like, these Chinese watercolors. They always usually have some bamboo in those watercolors, because the bamboo is just so slender. You know, it's very narrow, it's got these beautiful little knots in it, and it's sort of different shades of green. As the bamboo just tapers, and as it tapers, it bends just so gracefully. And even the little leaves of the bamboo are just so slender and nice, as if they were designed by some interior designer. They look so beautiful. And that morning, the way they swayed in the breeze was completely entrancing. And I just stood there looking at this clump of bamboo, and it was so beautiful I couldn't take my eyes away from it. And after about 5 or 10 minutes, I still was enjoying just gazing, enraptured, at this little clump of bamboo. Then I noticed there was a park bench close by, so I sat down on that bench and spent the whole time I was supposed to be exercising just gazing at this incredibly extraordinary beautiful clump of bamboo in the botanical gardens of Cambridge in England. And I had to tear myself away to go to breakfast. And so the following day I went back there, and again it was just so beautiful. In 8 days, this clump of bamboo was just entrancing, it was beautiful. After the retreat had finished, when I went back to my studies, so one day I had an afternoon free from lectures, so the thought came into my mind, let's go and see this most amazing clump of bamboo again. So I got on my bicycle and I cycled through the Cambridge traffic, and it's obviously very stressful. And by the time I got to the entranceway of the botanical gardens, I went in there and there was the most uninspiring, dirty, spindly, dry clump of bamboo. It's the same clump of bamboo that was there before, but now it looks just so ordinary, so grubby, so uninteresting. And it was such a shock to me, because during the retreat it looked amazing, but now after the retreat, just it looked like it should be cut down because it wasn't thriving in that climate. And of course I thought, what is going on? Has the clump of bamboo changed? And of course it hadn't changed at all. I had changed, or rather my mindfulness had decreased in its intensity, so I just couldn't see it anymore. It's one of the great benefits of developing mindfulness. You see more, and what you see is far more beautiful. I should have mentioned this last night. For those of you who are married to old ladies, your wife is getting a bit past it, that once you finish this retreat, you'll be able to look at her, and she does look more beautiful. She's no longer like the old dusty clump of bamboo. She's the most beautiful, entrancing piece of bamboo in the whole of Penang. And it's the same with your husbands. You actually see more beauty in things. You appreciate things more. So it's amazing just how that gives you a greater quality of enjoyment in life, just being mindful. And that's a lot of the reason why, you know, monks and nuns who meditate become happy. Now, it doesn't matter what we do, because we've got, you know, super mindfulness, whatever you see, it's really got high quality. Even when you go to the toilet and you look at your feces after you've done your job, you think, oh, that's amazing just how beautiful that is. Oh, my goodness. Look at those colors. Everything looks beautiful. So what one does, especially in the practice of meditation, one enjoys increasing the mindfulness by going slower. Some of you, I'm sure, have had some inkling of this. You may be in the morning, you just stand on that veranda and you look at the scenery. And you may have, you know, seen this scenery many times when you've been coming here to listen to a lecture or do things in this temple. But when you're on a retreat, you stand on that balcony, it looks so beautiful. On a retreat, you know, the sunrise or the sunset is special. And very many of you experience those moments of beauty. Please understand where they come from. It's because you've slowed down and your mindfulness is increasing. And this is an important part of meditation, to empower the mindfulness. And the whole part of meditation, where we sort of start with things like present moment awareness and silence and then watching the breath and then sort of watching the whole breath, this is a path of increasing mindfulness. For many of you who've come on your first retreat, sometimes you wonder, how on earth can you watch the breath for so long? It's impossible, because you can see the breath, there's nothing there to watch. And it's quite boring. But all one really needs is not to change the breath, but actually to increase the mindfulness a little bit more. As the mindfulness increases more and more, even the breath looks really, really attractive and beautiful. But more than that, you can see more of what's going on in the breath. Just like when I first went up that hillside, looking through a speeding car, all you can see is a few trees and rocks, that's all. nothing really interesting and not much detail, not much fullness of the experience. But as you go slower and slower, you start to see more, and what you see is more beautiful. It's the same when you start watching your breath. At first of all, it's just breath going in, breath going out. If I've got to spend 3 days just doing this, oh my God, this is boring. And how do these monks, is this what they're doing all the day, watching their breath go in and go out, go in and go out? That must drive you absolutely crazy. And that could be some torture in some sort of places. But no, what happens is as you start becoming more peaceful, your mindfulness increases, you see much more in your breath, and it becomes easier to watch. So don't give up or feel, oh, I can't watch this breath, it's not for me. You're just at the beginning. Stay with it, and after a little while, quite naturally, your mindfulness will increase. You'll go slower, more peaceful, your energies will come up, and you'll be able to watch the breath without much trouble. You'll see more. And there'll come the time when you're sitting there watching the breath, and it's the most beautiful thing, like my beautiful clump of bamboo, and you can watch it for hours. And you never get tired. So that's what happens with the mindfulness as it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. But the mindfulness, because it gets stronger, it enables you to be more subtle the way you use your mind. As you use your mind with more subtlety, because you're more alert, you see more things, you see how to get even more still. And the mindfulness has to increase as you meditate. And because it increases, you can go deeper. Because you can go deeper, it increases. Because it increases, you can go even deeper. As you become more aware of the whole process of meditation. And the other thing, as I was mentioning earlier, as you do go deeper, you do get happier. What you see becomes more delightful, and your bliss level starts to increase. Which is why that when people come and ask me about their meditation, one of the things I always look for is not what they say, but their facial features. Because if they know what they're talking about mindfulness and meditation, if they've been practicing these things, then they become happier little yogis. And if they're a miserable yogi, I don't care what they sort of say they've experienced. They may say they've experienced these great nimittas and they've become enlightened and they've seen the Buddha and they've been floating through the air. If they still got a miserable face, I realize, no, that hasn't happened. People who do develop this meditation, the shape of their mouth changes. Most people's mouths, the corners are turned down. As the meditation progresses, they become level at last. And as the meditation gets even more, the corners start turning up. And as you really get into it, they almost go to your ears. This is just the nature of the development of mindfulness. The happiness increases and you get more joyful and joyful and joyful. And this is one of the great things about meditation. You get a happy person. Now, a good example of this. Many years ago, when I was visiting my family in London, there was one of the monks over there. He was doing a lot of work in the prisons of United Kingdom. And he'd managed to talk the Home Office in the UK to having these Buddha statues in the grounds of some of the open prisons. He called them Buddha groves because, you know, Buddha statues are very popular in the West. Even people have them in their gardens. Simply because they are tranquil and peaceful. They're symbols of peace. And so even the Home Office, the psychologists, realized having like a symbol of peace inside a prison will be a wonderful place where prisoners of all denominations, religions, races could go just for a bit of peace and quiet to reflect. And that reflection, you know, may heal some of the pain in their hearts which caused them to commit the crimes in the first place. It's a wonderful little therapy. So he got the permission, and I just happened to be in London when they were celebrating the installation of the first of these Buddha groves in Spring Hill Prison. So I was invited to attend the ceremony because the monk was a big mate of mine. And so I went there in the evening, and they had all these dignitaries from the Home Office, the head of prisons, and obviously the governor of that prison, and a few other people giving their speeches. And after the speeches were finished, in an usual Buddhist ceremony, we do a circumambulation, which means walking three times with candles and incense around this big Buddha statue in the grounds of a prison. Now, we usually did that about twilight, just as the sun went down, it started getting dark. And as I was walking around three times, it was just a really inspiring thing to be part of. You know, all the hurt which criminals do in this world, and so often when people get released from prison, they go and reoffend again. It's just a cycle of hurt and harm, of pain and suffering. And so I was so inspired to see this was a really positive thing to be doing. And because I was inspired, I got very, very happy. Now, I was already a very happy monk, but now I took my happiness to another level. And like many of these ceremonies, there was always, you know, many people who were just on the edges of the ceremony, just looking to see what was going on. And there were two prisoners who weren't Buddhists. There probably was nothing to watch on the TV that night, because they all have TVs in these jails. So they decided just to go and check out, see what these funny robe monks were up to. And a couple of them were standing not that far from me when I passed them on my circumambulation. And out of the corner of my eye, I caught one of the prisoners saying to his friend, pointing to me, he said, "That monk's on the gear." Now, in prison speak, that means that monk's on drugs, on heroin. And the reason they said that, because they saw this big smile on my face. And as far as they understood, the only way you can get such a big smile on your face, such happiness, is through drugs. But I told them afterwards, because they were out there, I said, "No, it's not drugs, this is on meditation and mindfulness. Much better than heroin, and you don't get into trouble." So they were quite impressed. I'll always remember that, because they saw there was such happiness, and they could only recognize that from their experience with drugs. Now, amazing if you can have that type of happiness yourself. And this is just what occurs. The more still you get, the more mindful and the happier you become. The food tastes better, the scenery is more delightful, and everything has a greater taste. It's as if like you've been driving your car through Penang, and you think, "My goodness, the fog, the mist has been here all day." Until you realize you haven't cleaned the windscreen of your car. And as soon as you clean the windscreen of your car, hey, it's not foggy after all. There's no mist. It's just on the car, all the dirt and grime on there. And that's exactly what happens with mindfulness. It's like you clean your mind. You take off all the grime and dust, and you can actually see clearly. Life becomes sparkling again, fresh and bright, because you are waking up. To become a Buddha, you know what the word Buddha means? It comes from the Pali word Bujjati, which means to wake up. That's why very often they call the awakened one. So the more mindful you are, the closer you become to being another awakened one. And the more dull you are, the more sleepy you are, the less mindful you are, the further you are from a Buddha, from being an awakened one. So as you become mindful, you get more energy, more aliveness, more alertness. Life becomes more meaningful. You know, the opposite of that is becoming depressed. Why is it that these days depression is such a huge problem in all of our societies? Why is there an epidemic of depression? And what's the solution? Over in Australia, one of my friends, for those of you who went to that global conference which I organized last June, one of the speakers, he gave a keynote to open it and also gave a session on Buddhism and politics. When we invited him, he was our premier, the head of the West Australian government, Mr. Dr. Jeff Gallop. He was a very, very popular politician. But about 1 year ago, almost 1 year ago, he spent his Christmas holidays in the home of his best friend, who's Tony Blair,
because they both went to Oxford together, and Jeff Gallup was Tony and Sherry's best man at their wedding. So he spent Christmas with Tony Blair at Chequers, and that's where he realized, this Dr. Gallup realized, he was suffering from clinical depression. And so when he went back to Australia in early January this year, he called a press conference and to resign. It's a big political shock for everybody on the front pages of all the newspapers, because he was at the height of his popularity, a very successful government, everybody liked him, and he resigned because of depression. And he got a huge amount of sympathy. And since that time, he's gone to be a professor of politics at the University of Sydney in New South Wales. And just recently, because he's got a column in the Australian, which is the newspaper throughout Australia, every week, his own column. And he gave a couple of lectures recently, and so one in Sydney, one in Perth, and people sent me transcripts of those lectures because he was lecturing on depression and how to get out of depression. You know what he started off his lecture in Sydney? He said, "I want to begin by quoting from my good old friend Ajahn Brahm and his book, Opening the Door of Your Heart." And in his lecture, he was just quoting me all over the place as a cure for depression. And he's gone on record saying the way he's faced his depression and cured it was with meditation and Eastern philosophies, which is what you hear here, Buddhism. And it's one of the most prominent Australians who's basically embraced Buddhism and meditation, but especially for the cure for his depression. So actually, this is the best cause for depression, the cure for it. Simply because when you get mindful, you get bright, you get awake, and you see much more. What you see is happier, and you don't get upset or depressed anymore. This is how it works. People who get depressed get so tired and fed up. They live in a grey world where nothing has got any colour, the food just tastes bland, everything is just dull and dreary. That's what depression is. And this is the wonderful cure. You just get mindful, energies come up, and what you see is more beautiful, more delightful. You don't get depressed anymore. But we don't just do this to get out of depression. We just keep going on raising our happiness levels more and more and more. So the more you become in deep meditation, the more happiness you are going to experience, whether you like it or not. And sometimes you've been meditating and you become so alert, so awake, so much energy, that the happiness starts to flow. And it's because of this you get what we call the beautiful breath. Remember I called that stage 5 of this meditation? It's delightful breath. You're breathing in and out, feels so nice. Or some of you doing walking meditation, you're walking backwards and forwards, and oh, it's just so nice, you're just moving the feet this way and moving the feet that way, and you're just so happy and content, and you're having a time of your life just walking. That joy which comes up in meditation, don't be afraid of that joy, and don't go thinking, oh, I'm going to get attached to this. You are supposed to get attached to it, because it's the path out of suffering and to enlightenment. And if you read the text again and again, the Buddha said, monks, nuns, yogis, you should be able to discriminate happiness. And it's a type of happiness you should not follow, but the happiness of the mind, and this is one of them, you should follow, you should make much of. Go for it. Enjoy the meditation. And my disciples who know this, whenever there's a meditation retreat, there's a big queue. There's a fight to try and get on the retreats. I remember on one retreat which I gave, we were taking registrations at 6 o'clock. By 5:30, there was a long queue waiting before the tickets were sold, just like if it was like a Rolling Stones concert. And that somebody complained because they got 10 minutes before registration started at 5:50, But they were at the back of the line. By the time they got to the front, no tickets left. So even if they got early, they still didn't get a place on my retreat. Now why would people spend 9 days of their holidays doing meditation? Because they have a lot of fun. They enjoy themselves. You get a lot of happiness because of mindfulness. So mindfulness equals happiness. You empower the mind and you start to see things deeply. And of course that's a very, very, very important thing to be able to take the meditation even deeper. Because it's like the difference between playing like chopsticks on the piano and playing like Chopin. You know, anyone can with one finger sort of play a piano, make some sort of sound. But if you're going to play a very, very refined piece, you need a great deal of sensitivity, a great awareness of your fingers moving and the results of your fingers moving. And this is what happens when you become mindful. You become so aware of just how you're playing your mind and how just a little thought will either make that mind more agitated or a little bit of relaxing and letting go will make that mind just go deeper into meditation. You understand how this mind works and you can just tweak it, just gently nudge it into the deeper states of meditation because you're really alert and fully awake, not through force, happily awake. And this is where you find you can go into the deeper stages of meditation. There's more controls at your fingertips and you're more subtle with the way you can tweak those controls, which is how you can go into deeper stages of meditation. However, before you get into those stages and get great mindfulness, sometimes people say, oh, they still have so many distractions. They still have lots of sleepiness. They still get distracted by these thoughts coming into the mind. And they say that the thoughts come in by themselves. I don't know why they come in, they just come in. And please know, they don't just come in. They come in because you invite them in. Because you're getting bored. When you get bored, you invite other things to come in just for something to do. When you're happy and delighted, you don't get bored. In fact, when you get really, really happy, you get so mindful that all the sounds outside, whether it's the birds or people coming in and coming out, you just can't hear them. When you're enjoying what you're doing, the mindfulness increases, you stay with what you're doing, and all that's on the outside disappears. Like the example of two of my students in Perth. Now these weren't from Penang, but they were from KL or PJ, down the Klang Valley. So they did something very, very stupid. So you're absolved. It's those, you know, people from Klang Valley, you know what they're like. Or maybe some here, I don't know. Maybe I've already got in trouble. But anyway, they were in Perth one evening watching a movie on their TV. It was a great movie, and they were enjoying it immensely. And once the movie finished, you know, they got up to go to the toilet or make a cup of tea. And as they got up, they noticed something very strange. A few things which were missing from the room. And they looked very carefully, and there were some valuable items. They soon found out they had been burgled. And the burglar had actually come into the room where they'd been watching the TV and actually walked right behind the sofa and actually picked off stuff from the shelf right behind them while they were watching a movie. And it's a true story. They were so engrossed in the movie that this cheeky burglar, pushing his luck, but you know, he did it, walked right behind them and stole things from right behind their backs. Now, how could they do that? It's only because when you're watching the movie, you can't hear anything. And some of you ladies might know, who've got husbands who like the soccer. Sometimes it might be another 10 minutes to go before the soccer match is finished. And you could say, darling, somebody on the phone. Darling, someone on the phone. They can't hear you. They can't hear you at all because they're so engrossed in the match. There could be a fire, it could be an explosion, it could be a war outside. They just wouldn't hear it. because they're totally engrossed. Why can't you be so engrossed with your meditation that you can't hear anything outside at all? The sound of the birds, people coming and going, you can't hear it. You can do that, you know. Some time ago, there was a little novice in Ajahn Chah's monastery many years ago. Now, I grew up with Ajahn Chah. He was my teacher. And now he's actually quite famous. And he got the books of his, which are very inspiring to read. But when I read any of Ajahn Chah's books, it's very hard to recognize that as the words of my teacher. The reason is because he would give these long lectures, and most of them would be just so boring, you wouldn't believe it. But every now and again, he'd say something interesting and profound. And all those interesting bits, which is maybe about 5% of all he said, that's what is recorded in the books. That's what you get to hear. You get to hear the cream. I had to go through everything, the dross. It's like when people mine gold. If you've ever been in a gold mine, there's only a tiny fraction of gold, and there's all this rock and other stuff. But that's enough, because they get all the rock out, and there's a tiny bit of gold. That's what makes it all worthwhile. That was like Ajahn Chah's teachings. So in actual real life, they were very, very boring. But every now and then he said something very amazingly profound, and that's what you always remembered. It made it worthwhile. But this was one of those occasions when Ajahn Chah was droning on, saying this boring stuff you'd heard so many times before. And in this particular meeting, there was a little 12 or 13-year-old novice monk. You know that in Thailand, that people who haven't got parents, whose parents are too poor to look after them, they'd send them to the monastery and they get looked after. So this was one of those little 12-year-old novices. And he was listening to this monk Ajahn Chah go on and 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 on. And he started thinking, oh, when's Ajahn Chah going to stop? When's he going to stop? When's he going to stop? And it became like a broken record. He kept on repeating to himself, when is he going to stop? I'm only a little novice. I need my sleep. It's all right for these career monks, you know, these tough guys. But me, I'm only a little guy. I need my sleep. When's he going to stop? And he kept thinking this again and again and again and again. I don't know, for half an hour or an hour. But then he got what we call insight. He just flipped it around slightly. And he thought, not when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? He thought, when am I going to stop? And then he stopped. When he opened his eyes, it was the morning time. Hours had gone by. And he just, for the first time, got into his first deep meditation. Beautiful, blissed out, this little 12-year-old having a wonderful time. And when he opened his eyes, the hall was completely empty. Before the talk had finished, they'd all bowed to Ajahn Chah, done a little chanting, and gone back. He hadn't heard anything. He was deep inside, having a wonderful time. Now that's what can happen. You can actually focus so much, like your husband watching the soccer on TV, you can't hear anything because you're deep inside, absorbed, enjoying yourself. And that does happen on my retreats. This one is a bit short. There's always someone who misses their breakfast or lunch. I think one of the ones in Ipoh just recently, which I gave, one lady just went for 5 hours, right through breakfast, lunch, because she was having too good a time. She didn't hear any bells. Deep inside, having a wonderful time. This is how the whole outside disappears. Did I tell here the story of the archer shooting the bird through the... I did do that one here. This is actually how it works. When you start focusing, keeping your main object of meditation in the center, like the archer shooting through the left eyeball of the bird, if you keep that center in mind, all the things on the outside, like sounds and thoughts and feelings in the body, that soon disappears. It falls off the screen. In the same way, whenever you watch the TV, have you know, many of you have heard me say this, but those of you who haven't, have you noticed that when you first turn on the television, you can see the edges of the screen and what's beyond those edges? You may have like a photograph of somebody on top of the TV. You may have some, say, a DVD player underneath. Have you noticed that when you first turn on the TV, you can see all that's around the TV and even the edge of the screen as well? But after 1 or 2 seconds, you focus in and you cannot see the edges of the screen at all, nor anything beyond. All you see is what's in the center. And that's why it looks like real life, because you can't actually see what's on the edges, which actually define it as a TV. And in fact, I've been going on this aircraft for so long now, you see these very, very small screens which people watch the in-flight movies on. And they're tiny screens. But apparently, once you start looking on these, there's no difference at all psychologically between watching these huge plasma screen TVs. Because once actually you focus in, the edges completely disappear. You try this next time. If you go on a trip, maybe to Perth or somewhere, on one of these planes, look at that little screen TV in front of you. And then next time you see a big plasma screen TV, look at that. You'll find in your mind there is absolutely no difference. Because the edges disappear and you just got one image there. I've taught this to many, many people to actually get them to understand that these incredibly expensive plasma screen TVs are a complete waste of money, because psychologically, once you focus, it looks exactly the same as if it was a small TV. And actually, just the last retreat I gave in Perth, a couple of disciples, they actually understood what I was saying. And they said actually that they were saving up to buy a plasma screen TV, now they're going to stick to their own TV, and they gave the difference to my retreat center. And I thought it was really neat. Because the only thing about a plasma screen TV, you only notice it's so big when it's not turned on. But once it's turned on and you're actually looking at something, it's exactly the same in your mind as a small TV. Because what's on the edges disappears. And that's how we meditate. We focus, and all that's on the edges is what disappears. So if you're being distracted by thoughts or sounds or feelings in the body, remember the simile of the TV screen or the archer shooting the bird. Keep your breath in the center, right in the center. And all those thoughts, feelings in the body or sounds, you don't need to get rid of them. Don't make them a problem. If you make them a problem, you're actually bringing them into the center of your screen is the most important thing. They're just on the edges somewhere. Keep them on the edges, and soon they'll fall away. They'll drop off. Just like watching the TV. You start watching the TV, the whole house disappears, your wife disappears, the edge of the screen disappears, and all you got is the match. And that's what happens. You're watching the breath, all the other yogis disappear, I disappear, your body disappears, and all you got left is the breath. And that's when you get focused. That's mindfully focusing. And that's how meditation works. And when you can do that, it's so great, because whatever you do in your life, you know how to focus. Whether you're reading a book or you're perusing a contract, whatever you're doing, you learn how to focus and everything else disappears. It's a great skill to learn. And of course, also in that focusing, in that simplicity, you're slowing down and you're getting happier and happier. So that's why we meditate for happiness, for stillness, for power, for seeing things, and enjoying the amazing happiness of peace. So may you be mindful. Don't need to force it. Allow it to grow, because remember the first simile, walking up the hill, riding up a hill, or just standing still, the slower you go, the more mindful you will be. Mindfulness comes from stillness. That's how it works. Okay, is there any questions about that? The mindfulness today. For those of you who are on the verge of depression, because you're really sleepy and dull, try to do some interesting things. When you do walking meditation, as I said, try walking backwards. Or walk on one leg. That'll wake you up. Or if you're doing breath meditation, do backwards breath meditation. How many of you know what backwards breath meditation is? I will teach you backwards breath. Some of you have been disciples a long time, know what backwards breath meditation is. I will now teach you backwards breath meditation. Now, in a few moments, I'm going to tell you to close your eyes and breathe in and out three times. Remember how you did that before? You breathe in and out three times. There's going to be a difference this time. This is going to be backwards breath meditation. Now, I want you to close your eyes, all close your eyes, and breathe out first, then in three times. Out, in, out, in, out, in. Do that. And after the third in-breath, then open your eyes. But breathe out first. You breathe out first and then in. It's actually different than breathing in first and then out. It should be the same, but if you start with the out-breath and then breathe in, that's called backwards breath meditation. It makes it fun. And if you find that that's not going to wake you up, you can do the three in-breath to one out-breath meditation. You know how that works? You go... You notice when you're laughing, you're waking up? The more happiness you have, the more alertness and mindfulness you have. That's one of the reasons I tell jokes. It wakes people up, and they're more mindful. And then they can watch the breath much more easily. So that's how we meditate. Make it a bit of fun and games, and it's much more easy. Is there any comments or questions on that? Now, there's one question in the box here. You can put these questions in the morning on the box, especially about meditation. We've only got one question today. What have we got here? Oh, an intellectual one. Dear Ajahn, may we know why when one enters a state of Nirodha Samapatti, this is really still, cessation of perception and non-perception, one will not be destroyed by flood and fire. Thank you, Ajahn. Strange things happen when you get into deep meditation. There's one Indonesian guy I knew, a meditator. He had powerful meditation. It's many, many years ago. I don't know what's happened to him. I think he must have died by now. But this was many years ago when I was a young monk. And I met him and he told me his story, that he was in the jungles of Java meditating. And he said it was at night time, he saw some of the stars in the sky. And he said he focused on one, it became what we call a nimitta, like a light, which he emerged with and went into a very, very, very deep meditation for about 7 days. So he was sitting there absolutely still, not just for 50 minutes, but about 5, 6, or 7 days. When he came out afterwards, he noticed the trees around him. They were different. There had been some sort of calamity. He asked the villagers, and yes, there had been a flood. And he must have been immersed in about 2 or 3 meters of water. He never knew anything about it, and he was completely unscathed. Completely underwater for hours and hours and hours, maybe days, and not at all injured. And that's a modern story. So, isn't it interesting? In deep meditation, you are completely safe. The traditional story in one of the commentaries was this monk who used to get into such deep meditation. And he was in the jungle meditating, very still and very deep, when these two villagers passed by. They were going into the forest to collect some herbs or whatever from the forest, some mushrooms. And they came past this monk sitting absolutely still, Because they were Buddhists, they paid respect, but then they noticed that the fellow wasn't breathing. They looked closely and there was no sign of life whatsoever. So they thought, you know, we're Buddhists, we're devotees. If we leave this reverend here who's died, then the jungle animals will start to eat him. And that's not really respectful. And if I was meditating in the jungle, would you leave the jungle animals there to eat me? Or would you give me a proper funeral? So he thought, yeah, let's give this reverend a proper funeral. They were in the forest anyway. There's lots of wood lying around. So they spent half an hour collecting some wood, making a pyre. They lifted the monk on top of the wood, and then they lit the fire. And once the fire was established, they realized that, oh, you know, they've done enough now. Just the fire will burn them for the venerable and cremate him properly. And after all, they were busy people. So they went off to do their job. And you can imagine their surprise the following morning when that venerable walked for alms round in their village. They thought, you can't walk for alms round, we just burnt you yesterday. But in those deep meditations, you can't be burnt. You can't be destroyed by water. You can't be destroyed by anything. You are completely invulnerable. You are super monk or super nun or super yogi. I often think that, you know, I've been always reading newspapers and seeing that they have all these movies have come out in the last 5 or 6 years. Because I used to read the comic books when I was a kid, Batman and Superman and all these other superheroes. But the one superhero which they haven't done a movie about yet is Super Monk, who levitates through the air and saves people in distress and stops the bombs going up off and then gets to the terrorist afterwards and gives the terrorist the 5 precepts before he flies back to his monastery. Another good day for Super Monk. That'd make a great movie. And of course it'd be followed by Super Nun, because, you know, we've got to have gender equality these days. And Super Nun, who also goes flying through the air, using her psychic powers, you know, to stop people committing terrible crimes, and then giving all the women the 8 or 10 precepts or whatever you want. Super Nun strikes again. And then we can follow that up with Super Yogi. Super Yogi. Just a meditator from Penang, who's been on so many retreats. Whenever there's a problem, an aircraft is about to crash or a train is about to go off the rails and Super Yogi goes to their assistance and stops the train and manages to take the plane and make it land so softly, Super Yogi strikes again. Now you're mindful again, you see, you're waking up. That's why I tell these funny stories. So we can do these sorts of things. Because apparently these things are true. You do get sort of these amazing results. In the here they ask me why this happens. I really don't know why that happens. It just seems like one of these natural laws, that when the mind is so still, where there's a force field around you, or I'm not quite sure why it happens, but there's plenty of evidence that this is what happens, that when you're very, 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 very still, these things can't harm you. There's an old story from the suttas of Sariputta, the Buddha's one of the Buddha's chief disciples, and he was meditating and this big demon came along and just didn't like the look of this Sariputta and just whacked him one. And Sariputta never felt it. And his mate Moggallana, Mahamoggallana, he saw what happened and said, "Are you all right?" "Yeah, I've just got a tiny headache, but that's all." "But why'd you say that?" "So I saw this incredible, powerful yakka, this big demon, who swiped you. It's enough to knock the top off a mountain. You never felt anything?" "No." Because that's what happens when you get into deep meditation. Nothing will harm you. You will be protected. See? So this is not dangerous stuff. This is powerful stuff and protects you. But in the meantime, now is the time to do some more meditation, to be mindful, to be alert, and to see what happens later on. Do some lots of walking, lots of sitting, play around a little bit as well. Do backwards walking meditation or three in-breaths to one out-breath meditation. Make it fun, make it interesting, and you'll find that way that the enjoyment will go up, and with the enjoyment goes the mindfulness, and you get deeper and deeper. Until the time comes and the happiness becomes natural. And then you're off having a wonderful time. Any comment? Going, going, gone. Okay. So have a nice morning meditation. I'll be down in the library from 9:30 to 11 for interviews. And if you meditate well this morning, your lunch will be even more delicious. So that's the payoff, the incentive to meditate well. If you just go to sleep, then your food will taste bleh, just yucky and ordinary and bland. So it's up to you. Hope you enjoy your lunch.